It's Monday, January 27, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. This is shaping up to be a big week. On Tuesday, President Barack Obama will be delivering his annual State of the Union address. We'll be talking about that tomorrow, already in anticipation of the president's address. Both the White House and others are putting out signals of what the president intends to address. According to the White House, to the president's advisors, the word is that the president's going to address mostly domestic issues. Again, we'll be talking about that tomorrow. Meanwhile, today, the biggest news is what happened on Sunday. As CNN reports, a wrenching court fight about who is alive, who is dead, and how the presence of a fetus changes the equation came to an end when a brain-dead pregnant Texas woman was taken off of a ventilator. That came yesterday. The court had made its order last week. The order said that she had to be removed from the ventilator at her family's insistence by 5 o'clock today. However, it was switched off at 11:30 a.m. yesterday. That was announced by her family's attorneys. The attorney said, quote, "May Marlise Munoz finally rest in peace and her family find the strength to complete what has been an unbearably long and arduous journey," end quote. This is a really troubling story. It's troubling at every conceivable level. Several months ago, this woman, Marlise Munoz, a young woman, a young mother, a young paramedic, was found passed out on her kitchen floor. She apparently had suffered from a pulmonary embolism. And even as her life was slipping away from her, she was taken to a medical center where all attempts to save her life were made. And at the end of the day, the medical center cited a Texas law stating that it was necessary that the medical center keep her alive on life support because she was a pregnant patient. The hospital acknowledged last Friday that Ms. Munoz had been brain dead since November the 28th when she came into the hospital and that the fetus she was carrying was not viable. Her husband, Eric Munoz, had argued that sustaining her body artificially amounted to what he called the cruel and obscene mutilation of a deceased body against both her wishes, his wishes, and the wishes of her larger family. This story came alongside a very similar and similarly tragic story having to do with a 13-year-old girl by the name of Jahi McMath, a girl who was experiencing what was expected to be a routine tonsillectomy in Oakland, California before the end of the year, only to fall into complications that also ended with her being declared brain dead. Her parents insisted on keeping her on a ventilator and eventually received court permission to take her out of the Oakland hospital to Texas, where she, along with Marlise Munoz, was the focus of a great deal of national and international attention. Jahi McMath continues on a ventilator right now in Texas, but as of 11:30 yesterday, that was no longer the case for Marlise Munoz. But the questions about this case continue. One of the issues that has arisen is the very definition of brain death. As we have talked about on this program before, no one who was brain dead has come back from that condition to life. Several people have asked the question, but is that actually true? When there are reports of persons who were declared brain dead who later did come back to life. In particular, the case of a young man by the name of Zach Dunlap. He was declared brain dead but walked out of the hospital 2 months later. How can it be said by medical authorities, even by medical authorities committed to the sanctity and dignity of human life, that one can never be brain dead, and yet this young man walked out of the hospital? The key issue, and we are all well instructed by this, is to make the distinction between someone who is actually brain dead — no person has ever returned from being actually brain dead, that's just dead — to being declared brain dead. That's a very crucial distinction. It is possible to be declared what one is not. And that's true in the case of brain death, but also in any number of other medical situations. It is possible that there is a mixed diagnosis. That's why there must be extreme care taken to make certain that there is not a minimal, bare declaration of brain death, or of death in any sort, but rather that there is an actual death. Writing in the Washington Times last week, Bobby Schindler, who is the brother of the late Terry Schiavo, he writes that it's very important to do this because there are so many mixed motivations and complications that are a part of this moral equation. For one thing, there are those who are trying to save money in terms of medical care who will argue that extended medical care for someone who is in a very low or minimal consciousness, not to say brain dead, is simply a waste of money. But then he also writes that given the fact that brain death in particular is being used or suggested in many medical circles as the boundary line for the ability to remove organs from a body, there is a commercial aspect to this as well. As he writes, the Milliman Report publishes the going rate for each of 12 different tissues and organs in the human body. A heart, for instance, goes for close to $80,000, a kidney, $65,000, a lung, $70,000. If all 12 tissues and organs could be harvested from a single patient declared brain dead, however unlikely, their total value would exceed $500,000, end quote. Now, that calculation of $500,000 is the value of the medical treatments that are allied to these transplantations. In other words, this isn't a crude medical exchange, at least at this point, between the seller of an organ and the buyer of an organ, but there is at least this much money transferred in the actual process of a legal medical organ transplant. As Schindler writes, these revenues, of course, do not include the additional revenues generated from the transplant itself, pre- and post-transplant care, and the pharmaceuticals acquired after surgery. If nothing else, the tragic account of the life and death of Marlise Munoz should chasten us, should humble us, to recognize the value of every single human life, and the great tragedy that a death like this is, a tragedy compounded by the fact that she was pregnant. She was expecting a baby, then at 14 weeks of gestation, when her illness occurred. This is a very tragic story. Whether or not the baby would have been viable or not, we now simply do not know and will never know. That compounds the tragedy. And anyone who cares about the sanctity and the dignity of human life must affirm the great tragic nature of this Texas tragedy. Also, as we went into the weekend last week, the United States Supreme Court extended the hold so that the Little Sisters of the Poor and other nonprofit religious groups are shielded from paying the fines that they would be obligated to pay under the Obamacare legislation for refusing to cooperate with the Obama administration's plan for the unfettered free distribution of contraceptives as a part of Obamacare. Dan G. Savage, reporting for the Los Angeles Times, writes this: the Supreme Court on Friday shielded the Little Sisters of the Poor and other nonprofit religious groups from complying, for now, with the Obama administration's rule that they provide free contraceptives and the health care insurance they offer employees. The justices, by the way, handed down their hold in a one-paragraph order that keeps in place, and this is the basic legal function of that paragraph, it keeps in place a temporary injunction that had been handed down just at the end of the year, that is on December the 31st, by Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor. In this case, this paragraph, handed down at the weekend by the United States Supreme Court, shields religious nonprofit groups from compliance with Obamacare until the case can be settled, at least settled for now, at the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. That decision expected later this year. Writing at Slate.com, the always interesting Emily Bazelon asked the question, did the Little Sisters of the Poor win or lose at the Supreme Court? Her subtitle, it's complicated. Well, it is complicated, and this complicated issue is addressed in a very responsible way by Emily Bazelon. Even when I disagree with her, I generally note the responsibility she takes in writing her articles and essays. She writes that there are two different ways to look at the Obamacare contraception mandate as related to religious nonprofits such as the Little Sisters of the Poor. On the one hand, she says, the order that the Obama administration has handed down to religious nonprofits that they must sign a document stating their religious objections to the contraceptive mandate and, furthermore, thus facilitating the insurance companies paying it on their own, well, she says one way to look at that is that it's simply akin to asking a Quaker to sign a statement that he or she really is a conscientious objector in order to avoid service in the armed services. But then she says there's another way to look at it. And the other way to look at it is that it requires, that is, the signing of that statement, requires the Little Sisters of the Poor or any other religious nonprofit to violate their own conscience by facilitating the actual contraception mandate. That's something that isn't required of the Quaker signing the statement that he or she simply is a conscientious objector on religious grounds. There are two very honest assessments in her essay. The first of them is this: no one knows exactly what legal status this document that the Obama administration wants nonprofits to sign actually has. What is it? No one actually knows. It's going to take a high court to decide what that statement actually is, and furthermore, if that statement is or is not constitutional. But her most important paragraph is this, and you'll hear the very parallel that I mentioned earlier. She writes, quote, honestly, isn't this like a picture you can look at and see two entirely different things? One view is that asking Little Sisters of the Poor to sign this form is like asking a Quaker to state his or her opposition to fighting a war in order to be considered a conscientious objector. You can't argue that saying you refuse to fight itself burdens your freedom of religious expression because it means someone else will go to war. But maybe, she writes, that's the wrong way to look at it. The alternate view is that demanding Little Sisters of the Poor sign this form to avoid a big fine compels the group to ask someone else to sin on its behalf. If you see this as the group opening the door to getting their employees birth control, which they have a genuine religious objection to doing, then maybe it's not fair to ask them to do that. End quote. Well, I think, inescapably, her second way of looking at this is the right way. But even if Emily Bazelon herself believes that the first issue is the right way to look at it, she deserves credit for honestly addressing the issue and for writing in this secular forum the fact that it should be at least possible to look at this as a picture in which you can see two entirely different things. That in itself is refreshing in terms of the national media and its understanding of the issues at stake. A few days ago, I dealt with the giant, massive interview with President Obama that was published in The New Yorker in recent days, that interview conducted by David Remnick. It is a very, very important interview, perhaps the most important interview of President Obama's second term thus far. As a matter of fact, if you want to understand Barack Obama as the man and as president, this becomes one of the most important primary documents. In my previous comments about this interview, I addressed the fact that the president was talking about marijuana. And I will not go back to those comments, but rather say there are two other important issues addressed in this interview. Several, of course, but two in particular. And both of these relate to the family and to sexual morality and to the issue of same-sex marriage and to the importance of the family itself. Remnick writes, quote, "The politician sensitive to winds and currents was visible in Obama's coy talk about his evolving position on gay marriage. President Obama conceded in one of our later conversations that it's only, quote, fair to say that I may have come to that realization slightly before I actually made the announcement, end quote, favoring gay marriage in May of 2012. The president then said, quote, but this was not a situation where I kind of did a wink and a nod and a 180-degree turn, end quote. Remnick then writes, the turn may not have been a sudden 180. To say that your views are evolving, though, is to say there is a position that you consider to be more advanced than the one you officially hold. And he held the evolved position in 1996, when, as a candidate for the Illinois State Senate, he filled out a questionnaire from Outlines, a local gay and lesbian newspaper, saying, quote, I favor legalizing same-sex marriage, end quote. Now, once again, we turn to a major, very influential periodical of the secular media to point to a very important item of documentation. Here, the secular media documents what we knew as far back as the 2008 presidential campaign. When President Obama was running merely as a candidate for the Illinois State Senate in 1996, almost now 20 years ago, he checked off in his own hand the statement saying, I favor legalizing same-sex marriages. Then when he ran for president in 2008, he said he opposed same-sex marriage, and he held that position all the way until May of 2012 when he said that his position had continued to evolve to the point that he now endorsed the legalization of same-sex marriage, and now, of course, he's calling for that nationwide. The evolution here, in other words, David Remnick points to, is not really an evolution at all. It was merely a return to a position he had. He documents the fact that even as the president says that he didn't do, quote, a wink and a nod and a 180-degree turn, he actually did do that very thing. But perhaps the most interesting section of this interview is the president on moral issues as a parent, not so much as a president. And in this case, he himself becomes a parable of some of the quandaries of baby boomer parenting, of parenting teenagers, especially with the kind of moral approach taken by the president, a moral approach in which, as we discussed previously, he suggested that he did not want his girls to do marijuana because he says, quote, it's a bad idea, waste of time, not very healthy, end quote. As I said then, that's not a very substantial piece of advice. And as I also said then, I believe the president's actually telling his daughters a great deal more. The president expresses in this interview the fact that he and the First Lady, as parents, don't want to be seen as prudes. But when you consider as Christians, the Christian worldview importance of the family, the nuclear family, also the natural family, that's that pre-political family in which you have a mother and a father married to each other and their children intact together in a household. With that in mind, there is insufficient attention that has been paid to a very important section of this interview with President Barack Obama. It's embedded in this paragraph, quote, I'm at the very end of the baby boom generation, which meant that I did not come of age in the 60s, says the president. I took for granted certain freedoms, certain attitudes about gender, sexuality, equality for women, but I didn't feel as if I was having to rebel against something. Precisely because I didn't have a father in the home and moved around a lot as a kid and had a wonderfully loving mom and grandparents, but not a lot of structure growing up, I emerged on the other side of that with an appreciation for family and marriage and structure for the kids. I'm sure, and again, this is President Obama speaking, I'm sure that's part of why Michelle and her family held such an appeal to me in the first place, because she did grow up with that kind of structure. And now, as parents, I don't think we're being particularly conservative. We're actually not prudes. But as parents, what we have seen, both in our own family and among our friends, is that kids with structure have an easier time of it, end quote. It is the case that I would wish for the president to have said a bit more there, but not a word less. And what he does say there is extremely important, and it is a very graphic testimony about the importance of the natural family, of the mother and the father in the home, and of the structure that simply comes in a well-ordered home. One of the things we might note in reading this paragraph is that the president and his wife do not want to be prudes in raising their children, but they do want structure. One of the things we need to note is this. When you have the natural family intact, and when you have the mother and father in the home with their children and all things being rightly ordered, you don't have to be prudes. You just have to be parents. The other big event of the weekend was the arrest in New York City of Vincent Asaro, a 78-year-old mobster who is now accused of having been a part of the $6 million airport heist back in the year 1978, the crime that was sensationalized by Hollywood in the movie Goodfellas. As Tom Hayes of the Associated Press reports, more than 30 years after the hooded gunman pulled a $6 million airport heist dramatized in the hit Martin Scorsese movie Goodfellas, an elderly reputed mobster was arrested at his New York City home on Thursday and charged in the robbery and a 1969 murder. As we said, the man is Vincent Asaro, 78, named along with his son Jerome and three other defendants in wide-ranging indictments alleging murder, robbery, extortion, arson, and other crimes from the late 60s through the past year. The Asaros are both identified as captains in the Bonanno organized crime family. They pleaded not guilty through their attorneys, were ordered held without bail at brief appearances in the federal court in Brooklyn, and are now very much the topic of national conversation. There are many issues from a Christian worldview to be concerned about here, and one of them is the ongoing hunger and thirst for justice. And it says something about our criminal justice system, that a crime that's 30 years old was still a live crime and that the investigation was still ongoing. Something else that becomes very clear from the crime investigation in this case, eventually people break. They tell the truth. The truth tends to come out. And in this case, the truth surprised the investigators. One of the things that surprised the criminal investigators in this case is that they didn't have the 78-year-old elderly mobster in their list of prime suspects in the crime. Why? Because they didn't think he was all that important. Why? Because he didn't have a nickname. Because in organized crime, you're not anything if you don't have a nickname. But then again, maybe that rule doesn't always apply. Maybe it's true that some of the police have been watching too many Godfather movies. Before I close, I want to invite you again to join me, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. We're going to be talking about many of the headline issues facing the nation, and it's going to be a spirited and very congenial conversation. Join us on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary tomorrow, January 28th at 7 o'clock p.m. For more information, go to the website of hashtagpros.com. That's hashtag written out, PROS.com. Also remember that this weekend brings the very first release of our new program, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call in with your voice at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Lots of questions have already come in. All of them are good. I'm looking forward to hearing your question. Again, that's 877-505-2058. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.